I looked up the program, and I saw the kinds of things that are going on here. And, you know, I think that, you know, what you're doing in this community and some of the papers that I looked at today, I think are extremely relevant to what is needed in this particular field. Granted, I'm rather removed from the kinds of activities that you work on in this particular community. You know, you're down in the operating system at the guts and trying to make, you know, OSs and so on and so forth more power efficient and smarter and so on and so forth. But I think those are essential components. And I want to throw a couple of words in there. One word is Arduino. We use Arduino very heavily. So I'm sure this community has a lot to do with the development of that. The second is something recent that my students bumped into called the Raspberry Pi. So one of my students was talking to another student about this Raspberry Pi in one of the research meetings. So I said, "Well, where can I get this Pi?" I said, "No, this is showed me this little chip, which is a little computing platform." And then we went to the lab, and he connected this. I don't think it's $29 or $39. It's like a computer. You can connect it to monitors and keyboards and everything. So, and now he's using this device called a Raspberry Pi, and he's connecting it into appliances. So he's embedding a Raspberry Pi device into these appliances. So there's always something new and fascinating that is coming out of your community. And again, I'm not an expert on the Raspberry Pi or the OS, but I'm a user. So you can think of the kinds of things that I do as on the application side. So I'm going to give you some high-level characteristics of the smart grid first. And, you know, one of the things about... So what is this smart grid, right? I mean, it's really what it is it's the addition of ICT, information communications technologies, into the power grid. And it also has to do with the fact that now the electric grid is changing. I mean, if you look at what's going on, I mean, you look at the power of... the price of gasoline. Just today, it went up 4 cents. I was listening to the PBS News as I was driving in. It's like $5 and some cents. And you know, it doesn't matter what America does in the last decade. America has not been able to control the price of energy worldwide. Before that, America was very successful in doing so. What it means is that you know, energy is going to be expensive, and the natural resources are going to be constrained. The world's population is going up. And that means you need to do, and if you have generation of electrical energy on, and you have a grid, then you need to be smart about it. What do I mean by smart? Let me give you one simple example. If you look at the power generation today, right, most of the big generation, the plants that do generation, they have a flat generation profile. And if you look at the consumption profile through a 24-hour cycle, so it kind of goes like this. Okay, so this is, you know, so midnight to midnight. So in the middle of the day, our consumption might be 4 or 5 or 6 times that in the middle of the night. That means that our consumption... So what happens to the electricity at midnight? What happens to it? Well, you can't shut down power plants, so you have to store the energy someplace. What else can you do with it? Well, guess what? Why not put this excess energy that comes at night into electric cars? Now, all of a sudden, you can be driving an electric car next day. Well, can you do it with the existing grid? Yes, you can, but can you do it smartly? No, and this is where I think, this community can develop, you know, interesting smart technologies that allow you to do things smartly and add smarts to the grid by adding embedded sensor networks and things like that in different parts of the grid. Now, the thing is that if you are trying to make something smart, you first of all want to have, you need to measure the pulse. So that's the first piece of a grid becoming smarter. That means you need to know where in the grid you're producing how much, where in the grid you're consuming how much. And then you take all this data together, and then you do something with it. That means that if you start creating all these small embedded devices all over the place, like the Arduinos and the Raspberry Pis, then you need to make sure that they don't consume more energy than eventually what you actually land up saving, or that they're not adding a huge load at 1 p.m. on a summer's afternoon. So that all those sort of real practical constraints that I think, if this community can develop the OSs and so on and so forth in an optimized fashion, those issues are taken care of. Now, so coming back to this whole business of the grid being smart, well, if you have a flat production profile and your consumption looks like this, then how can you make it flat? That means that, and what are the issues? One of the big issues is that, as it turns out that in spite of all the energy efficiency measures worldwide, for perhaps the fact, maybe because of the fact that our population is going up, or perhaps because, countries, the BRIC countries are getting richer, overall the energy consumption on the planet is up. It's just up and up and up. Total energy consumption is up. That means that you've got to do something. And on a hot summer's afternoon, what can you possibly do? Well, the utilities keep backup generators, and they turn them on. Well, they cost a lot of money, and they're very polluting. And that means that sometimes at 1 or 2 p.m., this happened three summers ago in the New England area where they were purchasing electrical power in real time that was, orders of magnitude higher than what would be the nominal price of power. And now all of a sudden, you have, consumption that has gone up. You're purchasing power. Instead of that, why can't they send a signal to every light, every air conditioning unit to actually just turn down, or maybe to the laptop, just to turn down the brightness by 2% or 3%. And maybe that's all that's needed. In fact, most of the time, that's all that is really needed. Or take the thermostat setting in this building and change it from 71 to 73 for the next hour or two, and then when this difficult condition passes, then you turn things back to where they were. So, but all of that requires a lot of smarts. It requires all these smart things to be integrated. It requires you to know how much energy you're consuming and things of that nature. And we're really at the very early stages of this activity. Okay, I mean this is I look at transformation of the old grid to the new grid, very much like the Manhattan Project. I mean, this is a big deal. This is not, and that's to go back to what Professor Srivastava told you, each of these grants tends to be big. That's because a lot of the funding really goes into the infrastructure. The research I do, and you will see through the presentation, is we do some work in the lab, and then we do some work in what I call the UCLA Living Lab. UCLA has its own cogeneration. We consume about, we make about 75% of what we consume. So we buy about 25% from the utility, we actually make the rest. That means that we are like our own utility, so we can do some very interesting experiments right there. So the addition of ICT, so I would say there's sort of two key things. One is the addition of information communications technology, and the grid, I think, will change as you add that. The second has to do with generation sources. As the old nuclear and coal-fired plants are decommissioned, everybody is basically screaming, saying, I don't want a coal plant or a nuclear plant in my backyard. What do you do? Well, that means that adding generation will be a lot more expensive than what it was. Well, if you have so much sunshine, for example, here in California, why not encourage people to put solar on the roofs? That means that the second thing that's going to make the grid smarter, in fact, that's going to result in havoc and chaos if the grid is not made smarter, is distributed generation. It's distributed in the form of solar rooftops, wind generation, okay, and also smart energy consumption by way of electric cars. There is so much energy available at night that if you could store that into electric cars and drive electric cars in the day, you could drive a lot cheaply. The net-net, if you had to convert dollars per gallon on the electric car, the Nissan Leaf, for example, that we're using for our testing, the net-net comes to be about $1 per gallon. Right? So that's a pretty good deal, considering now the gasoline is just becoming so expensive. So in addition to being, in addition to keeping the air around the city of LA clean, and in addition to helping the grid operator consume energy at night, it's also economical now. So what does the grid operator do at night when they have excess energy? Does anybody know? Yes? They pump up water, but the amount of pumping capacity they have in America is so small. It's a tiny fraction of the excess energy at night. What else do they do? They pay. So the crazy thing is, many times at night, the price of energy becomes negative. That means they'll pay you to consume it. Why? Because they can't shut the plants down for... this is the problem with large-scale generation. Well, guess what? If we were to move to solar distributed generation on homes and rooftops, now you can turn things on and off at a home level. And so moving to solar makes a lot of sense. And for example, if you look at in Germany today, roughly 20% of Germany's generation comes from rooftop solar. Now, Germany, granted, I mean, they gave a lot of incentives. But in America now, we're starting to see some of those incentives that are popping up. Of course, our grid is very diverse. We have more than 3,000 utilities. It's very complex. We have, you know, the large investor-owned utilities, and we have some of the, you know, the mid-sized metropolitan utilities, and we have the co-op. So it's kind of, the scales are humongously different here, and they're all interconnected, and some of them operate in the free market, some don't. So it's kind of a patch job. But nevertheless, it is connected. And so, and we're heading more towards, you know, more and more towards sort of the free market-based approach. And so, you know, at night, the price of electricity is negative. So they pay these big buildings to keep the lights running sometimes. And those are some of the challenges of electricity. And, you have to do something with it. You keep on producing it. So you either use it. You can't just say, I'm going to produce it and just, you know, keep an open terminal. You can't keep an open terminal. You've got to close that terminal. You've got to have the electrons flow around. And you've got to have a load. There's got to be a load. Now, you could charge your cars at night. And that's why today, in Southern California, many of the utilities are offering at night the ability for you to have what's called a time of use meter and store electricity at night in your cars, and they sell it to you at half the price of the daytime. And that also is profitable to them because, remember, sometimes they have to pay people to use electricity. So, of course, the utilities are very interested in electric cars. You know, they would love everybody to be driving an electric car because all of a sudden they have now become, or they could become, yet another type of a gas company. So in terms of, you know, the renewables that are going to happen, okay, I think they started to happen already. Just on my street, out of the 12 homes, 2 homes have solar. Energy efficiency, I mean, like I said, if we are now operating so close to our maximum capacity in America for many days of the year, and 25 years ago we were not, that means that, you know, we basically need to have more energy efficiency measures. We need to have benefits to consumers. At the end of the day, you know, if the consumer doesn't see the benefit, then people aren't going to adopt this technology. And electric vehicles have to be integrated. I talked a little bit about that. We'll talk more. Peak demand reduction via demand response. This is very critical. So this is essentially the situation that happens during afternoons in places like California. And in some other parts of the country, this happens in the evening when the offices are still open, that they're running heating and people come home and turn the heating on, or they come home and turn the air conditioning on, like in the case of Texas. So if people come home at 4 and let's say the offices are open till 6 or 7, there's another localized peak there. And you know, nature doesn't like peaks, right? Nobody likes peaks. And so there, one of the things we're doing is we're doing what's called automated demand response, whereby we're sending signals directly to appliances and to electric cars and to homes, to lighting, and have the people sign on, have users sign on ahead of time on a mobile app or whatever, and then send the signal in real time to achieve direct load control. Now, there are challenges, right? I mean, we don't, as a society, we don't know if we are all agreeable to that or if how many people are agreeable to that. Chances are that there'll be a small fraction of us who would agree to that, and then we would expect to get some compensation in exchange for this inconvenience. And that's how, you know, that's how sort of the market works. But that's already happening. In fact, that has already happened in commercial load. So, for example, if you are running a factory or an office building, and this has actually been there for a long time, you know, if it's hard, the utility will pick up the phone and call you and say, well, you know, you signed up for this program ahead of time, so now today I need you to cut load by 20%. You know, you're consuming 80 megawatts. Can you cut it by 20%? And so, you know, so you basically then go do your stuff, and then you get compensated. Or in real time, if they're in trouble, they may call you, say, look, you didn't sign up, but we're desperate, and we'll pay you this much. So, you know, but that's a manual approach. It's you know, sometimes what happens is that you may have signed up as an organization, and they sent you, let's say, they called you and they left a voicemail, and you know, you were not there. And this has happened a lot where you're not at your desk and you got the voicemail, you know, you're out somewhere else. and now all of a sudden the utility didn't get what they were expecting, and you have a contract you sign, and all of a sudden you're going to have to pay a fine of millions of dollars because you didn't help them. Why? Because remember that if they don't get that reduction from you, they're buying on the spot market. And the price in the spot market could be anything. I mean, you'll be surprised. It could be 100 times the nominal price. And so, so in that situation, no one wins. So why not automate these things? Why do we need to have somebody pick up the phone and then tell 10 people? Or why not have all of these pre-done as policies and SLAs or service level agreements and have those? I mean, internet, everything is connected. But, you know, so why not do it? And so thing is that today, for example, many places, for example, inside UCLA, you know, things aren't correctly metered, okay? So that, for example, if you want to turn off lighting in certain buildings, you can, or you can have the smart lighting controls in certain buildings. In certain buildings, they don't exist. In certain buildings, the air conditioning systems have that ability. In certain buildings, they don't. So in terms of infrastructure, a lot of changes are needed. But that's another area of research. It's called ADR, Automated Demand Response. So we actually have that activity. And market-oriented pricing, right? So why don't the utilities just give you an incentive by way of reducing the price, you know, during off-peak hours? Well, they're doing it. For commercial customers, that's always been in existence. For the residential, it's starting to happen. For example, in certain parts of Texas, a couple of years, year and a half ago, one of their utility experts reported at one of the conferences that we had organized that at 6 p.m., the price of energy went down from 24 cents to 6 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, that's a big change, right? Now, when you see that kind of a price difference, right, then you'll start to act. If the price was, let's say, 12 cents and 10 cents, you'll say, yeah, you know, and that's what has been the case, right? Traditionally, in many of these places, the price difference was so small, you don't really care. But when the price difference is so big, you really care. It's sort of like in Los Angeles. For those of, for example, in Santa Monica, some of you who may have lived or live in Santa Monica, you see that the price of electricity goes up dramatically if you go from, you know, depends on how many kilowatt hours you consume. If you consume certain number of X number of kilowatt hours, your price for electricity is whatever, let's say 15 cents. And for the next block of kilowatt hours, it will just shoot up. And that has resulted in a change of the behavior of the customer because they see, you know, 1 month my bill is $100 and next month it's $250. Oh, what happened? Well, I didn't increase my consumption by 2.5 times. I just added maybe 50% or something. And so that type of a pricing really results in a jolt to the customer and the customer response. And that's what the utilities are realizing, that, oh, you know, if you do 10 to 12 cents, that sort of is not that important. But when you start making a significant, if you want a significant change in the customer behavior, you have to have a massive differentiation in price, depending upon what you want to incentivize. So many utilities are now talking of three or four price levels in a 24-hour cycle. That means, you know, certain price for early morning, then for, you know, afternoon and evening and then late night, things like that. And that, I think, will result in a better response by the consumer. And in that case, imagine if the price of electricity from noon till 5 p.m. on every day of the summer, and you knew that, was 5 times the price at night. You know, you'll ensure that you'll tell your cleaning lady, don't run the dryer until 5 p.m. And you may actually invest in a dryer, because electric dryer runs at 6 kilowatts for an hour. Okay, so now if it's 5 times or 10 times at that time, you'll go buy a smart dryer. I would buy a smart dryer. So my lab, for example, is building a demand response enabled dryer. You know, and so those are some of the things we'll talk about. And better control. This is very critical for the utilities. In San Diego, they reported that about a year ago or so, one of those folks there reported to me that in certain neighborhoods they were finding that there's a lot of solar, and you know, when there's a lot of solar in a certain neighborhood, and when cloud cover comes, all of a sudden the voltage drops and so on and so forth. Now, generally, what happens is that if you have a generator that is generating energy, and if you remove that generator, suddenly take it offline instantaneously, like you pull the plug, then the voltage and the frequency will sag quickly. And then you need to inject volt var back into that particular region. And so how do you inject voltage and frequency back? Well, you do have some generation. So one of the problems with wind and solar is that when the sun is shining, it is actually a generator for the utility. So, you know, at 11 a.m. on a Tuesday morning, right, chances are there's nobody in your home, and you are, let's say you've got a 5-kilowatt system, your home might be consuming half or 1 kilowatt, and the rest of it goes back to the grid. That means your home and the homes collectively in a neighborhood, if they have a lot of solar, are acting as a mini generator, and guess what? The generation goes away instantaneously because of a cloud, and now you have perturbations on the grid. And this is actually a very big problem that can get bigger. And this is where the utilities need to have better monitoring, better decision-making, and better control. What's going on in my grid? So really, to me, a grid, the grid is a massive, giant control system where you're trying to predict what's going to happen in the next microsecond, and millisecond, 1/60th of a second, that's the duration of a cycle on our grid, right? 1 second, 5 seconds, 15 seconds, a minute, an hour, day, a month, a year. So you're your control systems are operating at those scales. And there's a lot of information technology that's needed. So our center, SMERC, we do many things. We host these smart grid thought leadership forums in which we invite people from different walks of life. So we actually invite people from the utilities, of course, they're very critical. From industry, we invite folks from California Energy Commission, the CPUC, California Public Utilities Commission, the two commissions. We invite folks from EPRI. We invite folks from the regulatory bodies. And this is very critical. So, for example, you see Commissioner Timothy Simon. These folks actually set the rule. They regulate the utilities in the state of California, the big utilities. And so the idea is that at the end of the day, if you want to make a change in this world, I think you need to do lots of different things. And so, you know, our forums are very much like this. We do every 6 months. So the center itself is funded. Dr. Srivastava mentioned that we have a grant from DOE. This is LADWP is the prime, which is the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. It is the largest metropolitan utility in the nation. And it is part of the city of Los Angeles. And then we are three partners. And even though we do fight on the sports front with USC, this is a local rivalry thing going on here. But we do actually collaborate with them very nicely in the academic world. And then we also work with Caltech JPL on this grant. And the two areas that our group is leading in UCLA is one is demand response, and the other is electric vehicle integration. And then the other areas are that the other partners are leading. Actually, I shouldn't say we're leading these two areas. We're co-leading these two areas. And the other areas which are handled by the other organizations include cybersecurity and then the behavior of the customer. And then the other research project is with the Korea Institute of Energy Research. That's a 10-year grant in which we are working with KIER and on what is known as a smart green building for the grid. That means that can you treat a building as a microgrid and can you model it as a microgrid? And microgrid is something that can have that has generation in addition to load, so that it can either get off the grid for a certain period of time or it can reduce its consumption. So in a sense, UCLA is a microgrid because we, like I said, we generate about 75% of the 60 to 70 megawatts of peak consumption. I mean, think of it. We have about 60 to 65,000 people in the daytime. We have, more than 20,000 parking spots. So this is a very significant, entity in a sense. It's a little town. Then we have a grant with EPRI. It's a DOE-funded grant to EPRI. It's on cybersecurity, where creating test scenarios for security on the communications infrastructure that connects buildings to garages at the local area level, and what are the cybersecurity considerations there, and then we have an industry partners program in which we have 18 member companies that participate in give us equipment and all the good things. Moving on, let me give you a high-level view of the current grid. So you see on the top you have generation, and then you have transmission, and then you have distribution, and then you have consumption. So this is the traditional view in which you have large generation, then you have high voltage transmission, then you have the low voltage distribution in the cities and neighborhoods and so forth, and then finally you have the consumption, right? So that's a very simple, strictly traditional hierarchical model in which everything just flows one way. But the grid of the future, I think, is basically going to be very different. It'll be non-hierarchical. You know, we're really, I mean, you know, you can call it, you know, peer-to-peer or whatever you want to call it. But that, I think, will be the big change. And on the wide area, you know, for example, we're adding on the big generation, we're adding solar and wind right here in California. So like in the Tehachapi Desert, there's a big wind plant that's being added. And in the Mojave Desert, there's a big solar plant that's being added. So these will be, you know, of the order of, you know, hundreds of megawatts when completed. So that itself, even on the generation side, you know, what do you need to do now? You could have pumped storage. Pumped storage is this water pumping up the hill, but the delay times are high on that. Imagine if you're doing wind or solar, and the wind suddenly stops blowing, then what happens? And let's say you had 1,000 megawatts of generation, 1 gigawatt, but you know, and let's say, you know, the city of LA is give or take about 6 to 7,000 megawatts. You're generating practically 15%. If that generator was feeding the city of LA and feeding about 15% city of LA, and if all of a sudden that disappears, that means you need to have some mechanism to balance this demand. And the way electricity works is interesting, right? Electricity works, it's very interesting. It pulls, okay? Loads will pull. That means that if you don't have enough generation, the loads will still keep pulling. And then voltage and frequencies are going to drop, and then things will just go out of whack, and then there are these circuit breakers that will trip, and then parts of the grid will actually get shut out. And that's what happened, for example, in San Diego, last year in November, when one of the sources kind of got cut, but the San Diego still continued to pull load, and then the San Onofre power plant, the nuclear plant, which is sort of in question these days, that saw that somebody's pulling too much excess power, and so it shut down. So these are safety considerations. So all of a sudden now, San Diego had no energy, right? I mean, if San Onofre didn't shut down, they would have still gotten some energy, but unfortunately, you know, loads behave in this manner that they literally are sucking power. And so, at the end of the day, what happens is that if the city of LA is sucking power from this wind plant, the wind or the solar, and suddenly it's no longer blowing, then what do you do? So you need to have this intermediate. So you see that that particular item there, that's battery storage unit, and that's, I think, is going to become very important. And these batteries are not just your generic batteries; they're very smart batteries. They have a lot of computing capability. Each cell is monitored and controlled, so you can do very interesting research there, I think. And so the utilities are now starting to look at battery technology. What's the biggest problem? Battery technology is very expensive today compared to pump hydro or anything of that nature. But nevertheless, the time constants are much, much lower, and so you could literally turn them on in a fraction of a second. And there's another technology which is called supercapacitors, and that is even faster than a battery by, I think, one or two orders of magnitude. So that's another technology that they're looking at, but that's even more expensive. So the interface from the generation transmission is going to change. Down here on the consumer side, we've talked of electric cars, we've talked of solar. Solar sends power back to the grid. Electric cars in the future, you'll be able to charge them at night, and then in the daytime, send the power back to the grid. Well, why not? If the utility is willing to offer you $2 per kilowatt hour, and let's say you had 25 kilowatt hours stored, you could just make a cool $50 for just connecting just leaving your car plugged in. You don't have to do anything. So my research lab has actually built a prototype that is in the lab now, and one version of it is already installed in UCLA, in which we have about I think about 10 or 12 cars already plugged in. These cars don't belong to my project. I have a few, but then people who work in UCLA are plugging their EVs into this research platform. And again, the idea there is to be able to do smart charging, where you're not just plugging in and drawing electrons as soon as you plug in. You plug in, and you go away, and let's assume that people leave at 6 p.m. from UCLA. I'm just saying, let's assume that. Or if somebody leaves at a different time, you can enter your own preferences on this mobile app, and I'll show that to you in a few minutes. And the system then takes over, and the system figures out, depending on the grid conditions, it will then charge, and it'll charge you. And then as soon as we're adding two electric vehicles that also can discharge into the grid, and that they will come online in March. And as soon as they come online, then we can even experiment with discharging algorithms. Now, that's more challenging, and we'll get to that later. You know, it has all sorts of facilities, considerations. What if a transformer is not a bidirectional transformer? Things. So there's a lot of practical considerations there. But for charging itself, you can do smart charging. For example, if the utility says, well, today from 1 to 3, the price of electricity is going to be so much. Maybe you don't want to pay that much. I'll give a simple example. One of the cars that we have in our project is a Chevy Volt. So we're experimenting. With the Chevy Volt, you can drive 40 miles on electric and the rest on gas. So you always have some gas. So the Chevy Volt owners, I talked to them. They say, if there's some Chevy Volt owners that have the private owners have Chevy Volt, and also the Toyota Prius plug-in, now you have that available as well. So if you talk to them, they say, if the electricity is cheap, I'll take it. If not, I still have my gas. I'm still paying whatever, $4 a gallon. So for them, they don't have to get charged by 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. But for the Nissan Leaf owner, especially somebody who's driven 50 miles, well, they better get charged at the end of the day. So they're willing to pay more. So it's very interesting that all of these nuances are actually coming out in terms of the research project that we're doing. And so what do? You have an app that lets them put their price threshold. And then our system then does the optimization and, with N vehicles, with everybody having their own personal preference. And taking input from the grid operator. There's another input that we use, which is the input from the parking garage owner, which has to do with the amount of capacity that's there on a circuit. Like there may be a 20-amp circuit or a 40-amp circuit, and the question is, how many cars can you charge on a 20-amp circuit? You can give two cars 10 amps each. On a 40-amp circuit, you can give four 10 amps each. So that part of that's a constraint solving, so we do that as well. So then, the interface, as you're going to send energy back from down here. Imagine now, the consumer is the generator. Remember, I said that the transformers here on the distribution grid, some of them are not bidirectional. So how do you get power back? And so you have to upgrade the transformers. Well, that costs money. And now if you're going to upgrade the transformers, then you might as well get new solid state transformers and new smart transformers that can do other things and that can be monitored wirelessly and controlled wirelessly through the internet. And so people are inventing these technologies, and so the utilities are saying, well, now what do I put this old thing or do I put the new thing? And so it's changing. Things are changing. And a lot of the change is actually being brought about by the customer. And so that interface is also going to change. And eventually, imagine maybe a small township somewhere in which everybody's got solar, and they're feeding into, let's say, a transmission line. Well, maybe they want to send power back to the transmission line. Why? Because it's green power. Remember that in most states in America, there's a target for, especially California and Los Angeles, we're really leading in the country. And we have these very lofty targets for renewable energy. So if a small township is able to sell energy back to the grid to, let's say, Edison, and it's all green energy, Edison will pay a premium because they need to hit this target. Otherwise, they have to pay a fine. So, and when I say Edison, I don't really mean Edison per se, but I'm just saying a general utility that has to reach a target. Okay. So what are the technologies? And this is where I think that this community should be interested. I mean, every possible technology that is out there is being used. Okay, there's a lot of cloud computing going on, a lot of wireless communications, because the moment you have, for example, smart meters in America, the smart meters that are going into residential locations are wireless. So either it's a proprietary network or it's some sort of a 3G network, or mostly it's a combination of them. And they're not using PLC. PLC stands for power line communications. That means, you know, sending the data through the power lines. But they're not using that in America because of many, many practical considerations. And it's much cheaper to do wireless in America. You know, we have a large landmass and so on and so forth. But so if you look at wireless communications, that itself is a big opportunity. Sensing and control, that includes embedded systems. Storage, in this case, storage is energy storage, okay? That means batteries or other sources of storage. Mobile devices, user interfaces, embedded systems, and then the renewable sources, right? So the ICT layer and then the new class of generation, that is solar, wind, biomass, geothermal, hydro, and so on and so forth. Who are the key players in this business? The big players in this business are DOE, ARPA-E, NIST, FERC, NERC. FERC, NERC are the federal agencies. They do the regulation. FCC, communications, utilities, telecom companies, vendors, societies, venture capitalist startups. Okay. So I did talk about our research project, so I'll move on. So this is UCLA. So on the left, you see we are part of the distribution grid. Then you see the UCLA Electrical Gateway. That's really a concept. And within that, we have the cogeneration. So some of the energy is coming in through a metering that is being metered by the utility. And then some of it is coming from our own cogeneration. And that goes into the buildings and the parking lots and the residential halls and the labs and so on and so forth. And then eventually you get into the loads. And so that traditionally has been unidirectional. And where I think the interesting stuff is starting to happen is as we are putting in all of these WAN, LAN, NANs, these are all the communications things. WAN is wide area network, LAN is local area, and NAN, some of you may not have heard of NAN, it's neighborhood area network, it's just something in between. But nothing that great, it's just a term. But if you start thinking of solar and electric cars that are going to send energy back to the grid, there's a lot of things that can happen, and we really don't know the future. Okay, I think we're sort of inventing the future as we go along. Meaning what? Meaning, I should be able to buy a solar cell, really, from a Radio Shack or a Walmart, and then plug it into my home, connect it. There should be two connections. One to the power outlet, one to the IT, through wireless or through my Ethernet port, and that's it. And I should hit a button, and then everything should be taken care of, right? Today, it's a nightmare. You take this permit and that permit, and then there are all these middlemen who have to get, who have to make their money, and so they come to your house, they do the inspection. You know, all of that adds to the cost, and in the future, I think that the plug-and-play approach could be a fantastic thing, and the ICT community has created plug-and-play and very successfully. So, for example, I come here, I have this adapter, I take my Apple, plug an adapter here, and I plug this into this cable, and I'm projecting here, right? I don't need to have somebody, an IT expert here doing this, but that was the case 20, 25 years ago, but today it's not. And I argue the same thing's going to happen. It's going to take a long time, maybe, one or two decades. Similar with electric cars. I just want to plug it in. And for example, the prototype system that we have developed, that's what it aims to do. That's still a long way off from sort of commercial, if you will. But if you could do that, what does it mean? It means that you have connected a solar generator onto the grid, and you need to send power to the grid. Now, somebody has to be there to take your power, and there should be some contract that has to get signed by somebody to be able so that they can take the power when you're not using it, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that has to get automated eventually, and plug and play, that means that your solar has to be able to send a message to the grid, this thing called the grid. If in the future there is a grid, maybe in the future there are many grids, and you send it and somebody's listening, like a ISP is listening, and the ISP says, oh, I see you. Okay, here's the deal, and I'll buy your energy. That means that the traditional model of the utility was the power flow was unidirectional. The control flow was unidirectional, and the communications was unidirectional. And I think all three of them are going to be turned on the head. And those are the experiments we're performing in our labs. It means sending the communication from here upstream and somebody and convincing that entity up there to listen, I mean, that itself is going to take some time. That means that this thing called a utility of the future should be listening all the time, and I send this message, and now they're willing to take my energy, and I get some money for it. And that, the utility has to be ready to do that. And if for example, today, if 100% of the generation was solar, rooftop, the utility wouldn't know how to control this grid. They would not be able to control the grid. So you may ask, what's the magic number today? Is it 5%, 10%, 20%? We don't quite know. We really don't know. Some people throw numbers that, you know, well, oh, if solar is up to this much, we're still okay. We don't really know. And so this is where I think the challenges lie, that, you know, I always tell people, I love the word beta, version 1.0, version 2.0. When people start talking about version 2.0, and when version 1.0, we haven't learned our lessons, that's nonsense. You got to go through beta, got to go through 1.0, then we know 2.0. There's people making predictions of smart grid 2.0, and I completely, completely don't agree with that. So we're in the beta stage. So that means the communication will be this way, the control will be this way, okay? Or it'll be both ways. Two-way communication, okay? Two-way control and two-way energy flow. So those are going to be the changes. Now, let's look at one example, the demand response example, in the context of our project. So the utility sends a signal. So this is a utility-generated signal, okay? And it sends a signal. It can either go through a smart meter or through a gateway. It's just it's a signal. It could be some TCP/IP signal or anything, HTTP, whatever, FTP, I don't know, text message. It doesn't matter. It goes, and then it gets into the appliances. So it gets into the smart appliances and their controls. It can get into the heating, ventilation, air conditioning controls. It can get into the smart load controls. It can get into the smart load controls, and then it can get into, you know, different types of electric vehicle controls. And then these systems can, respond depending upon a predetermined agreement or a real-time agreement. If it's predetermined, fine. If it's real-time, like I said, sometimes they call a customer, say, well, I know you didn't sign on, but we're desperate, and here we're giving a much better deal. And the customer sign on. So why not automate that? That could come as a text message. Respond, yes, you're done. That's exactly the kinds of things that we're trying to demonstrate in UCLA. And we are using, well, we will be using real dorms to experiment with this. And it's a challenge to get people to sign on and all those things. A lot of infrastructure issues. There's people issues. There is RB issues. So it's a complicated process. So this just shows you some of a very basic interface that is being tested in the lab for a dryer, refrigerator, HVAC, electric vehicle, and lights. And just what happens when you send a signal? Simple, just, you know, you have a delay of 2 or 3 seconds and the power turns off, right? So you can either turn it off or you can actually turn it to different levels. So you can say, well, I need to cut the power from, 5 kilowatts to 4 kilowatts. So you can do that too. And that you can change cycles in the appliances themselves. So here are some of the appliances that, for example, we've been playing with. So you can see this is a what's called a backnet for interface, and that one of our students is building a wireless interface into that. In fact, that's one of our students from EE department, from Professor Money's department. And he's working in the center. And then this is a LED lighting. This is a refrigerator. And this is a dryer. So you can see, essentially, well, actually you can't see a whole lot, but you've taken a standard appliance and we added, either we're adding an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi or some other type of a little device, a little CT. You measure what's going on. You do an A to D. You do a little bit of computing there. You can't do a lot of computing if you use an Arduino. But this is again for your community in the future. Maybe I think Raspberry Pi is like a little computer, so that I think is definitely the direction to go in. But you got to make sure that you don't consume so much energy in the Raspberry Pi. We're still in the early stages of testing that, and I don't know how much energy it actually consumes. But with your operating system and so on and so forth, you want to make sure that's low as you can possibly make it. And then you basically talk back to the system. You talk to the gateway in the case of our architecture, and the gateway is sort of where gateway is basically a PC on the IP network, and that's one that that receives the DR signals and that negotiates with the different appliances what to do, what not to do, things like that. So we're actually trying to do come up with a very basic sort of a language to do this. There is a standard language called OpenADR. If anybody's interested, it's out of Lawrence Berkeley Labs. Lawrence Berkeley Labs is a collaborator in one of the grants, and I happen to be on the advisory board of the OpenADR research program at Lawrence Berkeley Labs there. So they really are pushing the standards, and it's been very successful. So we use that, and we get the OpenADR signals into the gateway, and then from there, we do our own little local control. The thing is, in terms of the delays, okay, there's a lot of applications on the utility side that really don't need to have a sub-microsecond or a sub-millisecond delay. Many applications, you just need a 15-minute delay. That's more than enough. And so there's something to think about. Okay. Now, the 15-minute delay is at an aggregated level, is at the grid operator's level. Now, you start to break it down when it goes from the grid down to, let's say, a substation and a transformer to a home gateway to the appliances. So you start adding all those times and so on and so forth. And one thing that does, keep in mind that, for example, air conditioning is the largest load in California. And air conditioning systems have a delay in the sense that if you change the temperature of an air conditioner, it doesn't mean that the load instantaneously drops. So every class of appliance has their own delay, right? So these are mechanical appliances with the pumps and motors and things like that. So they electromechanical. So they have their own time delays. So you need to do your own research in what kind of appliance you're going to use and how much energy it's going to give and what will be the delay. So these are just some of the details of that refrigerator. I think we've tried to show you the picture. There's a CT there. I don't know if you can see the CT. And then there are four relays on this side and so on and so forth. In terms of demand response, the research issues, in the interest of time, I'll think what I'll do is let me just say the research issues pretty much have to do with, you know, the control, what kind of data, the interface of the power system with the digital system, there's the safety issues as well. You have to take care of those. So, it's a very sort of an interdisciplinary. So you need people who understand electrical systems and people who understand the ICT side. So it's kind of a very interdisciplinary systems field. Moving on to the electric car project, ISAP's mentioned that we have the electric vehicle operator, we have the grid operator, and the garage operator. And our system takes into account input from all of them. So the first thing that you do is you walk in and you plug in your car and you have a mobile app. So this is a mobile app where you enter your preferences for the day, for the week, or whatever, and then you log in and you can look at the maps. So you can see on the top left screen is where this particular screen has the user looking at their own parking garage and so on and so forth. This is the preference screen. These are another preference screen. This is when you're looking at the map. So you basically got an app. You certify, plug in, and then you let go. And then our system says, okay, you're going to leave. Today you leave at 6 p.m. and you have said that you want to purchase energy if it's less than 10 cents. So then that's what you'll get. And this is where we're finding that people will plug in. At the end of the day, sometimes they'll come and they'll see, oh, I didn't even get a charge because of my preference. So the smartness involves people getting smarter about the system. And there's the iterative process. This is where I think we're in the beta phase. Then we have a control center. So in the control center, for example, you can look at all the cars that are out there. You can look at the status. You can look at how many kilowatt hours they've consumed. Remember, we monitor every 60 seconds. So we know voltage, frequency, active power, reactive power, all those variables, because those variables are important for us to study from a power system standpoint what is going on in these parking garages as people turn on and off their cars. Because remember, inside a parking garage, if you put 10 electric cars and you have the lighting, as the number of cars is increasing in these parking garages, the total load from the cars is a very large fraction of the total load. And in the future, it'll be like 90 to 95% of the load. That means that they really are the dominant load, not the garage lighting anymore. Because, we went down the path of, efficient lighting in parking garages many years ago. So this is a control center. This just shows you the interface between the electric vehicle grid, and we are adding a 50 kilowatt energy storage system. So the idea here is that early morning, when the sun shines, you still want to store that energy into, so we're actually adding 50 kilowatt solar as well. Sorry, I forgot to mention that. And then a 50 kilowatts battery system. Actually, so 25 kilowatts, 50 kilowatt hours battery system, because solar 50 kilowatts is peak. That means that, but on average, you're not going to get that. And then as people come in early morning, there's excess power based on our simulation. So you send that power into the battery system. And then as people drive in, you can even say, I want to, if it's solar energy, I'm willing to pay 25 cents per kilowatt hour. There's some people that are actually very green. At the end of the day, I think it's about choices. Consumers want choices. So in this system, we offer choices. This just shows you an overall picture here in the interest of time. Let's just keep on moving. So this demonstration project, I'm going to actually get to some more graphic slides here. So there's a research issue called aggregation. And aggregation has to do with the utility sending a profile of, let's say, a pricing for the 24-hour period or the amount of energy available and so on and so forth. And then I argued in the future that there'll be these aggregators that'll really understand the EV drivers and understand the smart consumer, and they'll be able to provide smart services by way of giving that particular individual a lot of benefit. Because the utilities are really, they don't have the time to worry about an individual. They're serving, 3, 4, 5 million customers, right? So most of the big utilities, at least. So for the big utilities, I argue that this whole aggregation model, I think, is going to be interesting. And so we have a student looking at this particular thing, this concept. I talked about the battery system. This is the battery system in the lab. This, we're going to put a larger version of this into the parking garage, and we've been running simulations of this and on this. One of the things about this battery system that is sitting on the grid is you can use it for very interesting things, including when there's a voltage sag or frequency sag, and so you can actually use it for multiple objectives. You can store to store energy, and so I think in the future that I think that technologies like this will start to show up, and it's just a battery with a smart battery management system. Okay, this just shows you some of the infrastructure. Like I said, there's some Nissan Leafs, there are some Chevy Volts, and that's the installation. That's my, that's one of our senior researchers, Dr. Chu. This is a one of our devices installed in parking lot number 9. We have our devices installed in parking lots 9 and 8 and lot 3. And basically, we should have about 15 or 20 of these devices installed in the next 1 year. And the idea is to cover UCLA's grid and study how, how people are charging and how the impact on the grid is with this particular infrastructure. So that's all communicates wirelessly. All right. Level 1, level 2, level 3 chargers. Level 1 is done. Level 2 is being worked on. Level 3. Solar to battery. This is a prototype developed by one of our master students. With that, I'll just say we're very fortunate. We've got some good visibility. Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu visited LA, and I got the good chance to meet him. Pat Hoffman, Assistant Secretary, she visited us, and we had an opportunity to host her for 2 days. Mike Peavy, who's chairman of the president of the California Public Utilities Commission, was here earlier, and he regulates the utility industry. And so I think we've been pretty fortunate. We've had Nancy Sutley from the White House. So we've got some pretty, I would say, and Mayor Villaraigosa is very supportive of this, and he hosted 2 workshops in the last 2 years, and I got invited to participate in both of them. And so I think LA is a great place for this work, and UCLA, I think, is a great place, and we have technical experts like Professor Manish Srivastava, who are leading the charge on wireless sensor networks through work that they've been doing with the SENS for the last several years, as well as on a lot of the CS, he wears 2 hats between the CS and W work. So the fundamental work is done by people like Professor Srivastava, and we sort of do the more the application level work. Thank you very much.
Please also remember to state your name and affiliation before you ask a question. So I'm Tom Wendish from the University of Michigan. So one of the things that I've found when I've talked to colleagues at places like Google and Facebook that, they're installing these charging stations for the Leafs at work, is that, you know, you said one of the motivations for electric vehicles is we want to charge at night. But my colleagues are all plugging their vehicles in at work because then their employer is paying for the power instead of them. And so, you know, that sort of undermines one of the goals of trying to shift the large consumption from the electric vehicles to night. So do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, how can we create incentives to, you know, still get the charging to happen at night?
Well, yes. And I just want to add to that. So, you know, I think we're going to, right now, a lot of the employers, including UCLA, I mean, even if you look at the infrastructure we're putting in UCLA, that infrastructure is really, people are there at day, during the day, right? Not at night. So, yes, I mean, we're doing a similar thing like what Google is doing. This is sort of the early stages, and we're really trying to figure out, you know, what people want, what do they, how they're going to use it, and when will they come in. Now, as we move forward, I think things are going to get more refined, whereby, you know, people would also install devices, for example, like the device we have in their homes that can tell the utility, that this person is also charging at night, and I think that, you know, the notion of having free electricity, that's a local phenomenon, and that it's there in many places. But that's not a sustainable. I mean, you know, everybody can't be given. I mean, for example, free gasoline, right? I mean, that's you know, maybe a few companies can give free gasoline, but that's not going to be sort of the norm. Right now, I think we're just trying to learn. But once we learn, I think what's going to happen is there'll be refinement. For example, suppose you do want electricity from, let's say, noon to 2 p.m., right? Well, then you pay more. Okay. Number two. Suppose you do want it, you insist on charging in the daytime, and let's say you're willing to pay more, how much more? Let's say you're willing to pay five times more. Well, in that case, maybe there's an economical model to have a battery, like the battery system that we're installing in UCLA, to store energy at night in the battery. And so I think a lot of that will sort of fall out over time. Right now, it's in very early stages. And so, yeah, if every company, every organization starts to give free electricity, I mean, what's going to happen to them? Is there something called demand charges? That means that you're supposed to be able to predict how much what will be the peak consumption. And so if your peak, and what will happen is one day the facilities person will come to the CEO and say, you know, what are you doing to my demand charges? And the penalty for going above a peak means, the way it works is, if you go above the peak for an hour in the whole year, the price of electricity that you pay for all the kilowatt hours you consume for the entire year goes up. So the penalty is very heavy. So these things are local, and they will, I think they will pan out. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. Very enlightening. I had a few questions, but I can. Yuvraj Agarwal, UC San Diego. So one of the things that sort of stood out was that, you know, at some point energy efficiency and demand response sort of go meld into each other. You know, once you're done with energy efficiency, whatever's perhaps left is what you do for DR, right? Especially when we were looking at buildings, we found out that most of it, once you were done with energy efficiency, there was not that much left in terms of reducing your load for DR. Have you sort of, you know, has there been some good study on this about how much, where is energy efficiency stop, or what you should be doing all the time, and then what is sort of left for DR at the end?
Oh yeah, that's an excellent question. Energy efficiency has to do with the following. Okay, I'll try and expound on what you were saying. Energy efficiency means that you enter a bathroom, and the lights are off, and there's a sensor in there, and so the building is smart and it senses you, and then the lights turn on, and so that is energy efficiency. So and you could take that energy efficiency even beyond. Literally, you can take all the corridors in this hotel and have all the lights turned off, and as you're walking down, the lights just turn on as you walk through. It turns out that the hotel will never allow that. Okay? Will never allow that. And so the hotel will say, no, the lights are going to be turned on whether or not somebody's walking through. When you do DR, you do that. When you do DR, that's when you have sensors, and that's when you turn the lights off where you don't need them. And so energy efficiency will stop, and we're already seeing, I mean, if you look at commercial buildings, they've put energy efficiency measures, you know, for the last 20, 25 years, and they're pretty efficient. They've really knocked off, you know, they've replaced, you know, the lights and so on and so forth. And for example, you look at UCLA, many of the UCLA dorms, you know, the lights are, you know, uh, no, the the lights are all, you know, very efficient, you know, and so on and so forth. And there's in some of the new dorms, they're going to put LEDs. And so energy efficiency will go till a certain way. And then you have to, you know, because demand response is sort of a different sort of a situation where it does not happen all the time. It happens for short periods of time. And it's sort of like, you know, it's like, a you know, you got hurt. And then, you know, you're going to put a Band-Aid on you, right? But if somebody says, can you wear a helmet, steel helmet with, you know, 24 hours a day, and so that you never get injured, you're not going to do that.
So. Maybe what you're thinking about it, energy efficiency is one where you don't sacrifice the quality.
People's comfort, yeah.
And demand response is where you're going to sacrifice.
Yeah. That's very nicely said.
So I was more thinking more, where does that give you 20% more? Is there, and it's something that we're trying to figure out too, yeah. Depends upon how much comfort you can sacrifice.
So maybe one more question, if anyone else wants to do it.
Xiao Song Ma from NC State University. Enjoy your talk very much. A lot of the problems you mentioned seem to be associated with the fact that we lack efficient energy storage. You also work on batteries. Do you foresee some kind of break there that is, you know, remove a lot of the problems fundamentally? Thank you.
I'm sorry. What's the question though?
So the question is, you know, you also, your research mentioned that you use some batteries to store the early morning solar.
Yes.
Energy, but then do you foresee in the next decades we can have so cost-effective energy storage, very efficient batteries that can remove the modulation problem, you know?
Okay, so you're talking about energy-efficient batteries. Yes, so, I mean, battery technology continues to improve, and that is still, I mean, there's a lot of innovation happening in different materials, right, lithium-ion phosphate, things like that. You know, there are a lot of faculty members, including even at, you know, places like, you know, UCLA. We have a colleague working on not battery, but capacitor, supercapacitors, which is a related technology, but different. You know, MIT A123. I mean, that was a significant innovation several years ago. So the battery technology has not stopped improving, and it is still getting cheaper and improving. Also, a lot of the manufacturing that has in China is resulting in reduced prices. So, I mean, to me, battery technology is in the grand scale of things, is still relatively new because we have not, think about it, we have not thought of making batteries of the scale of, you know, 50 megawatts. I mean, that we have not. And so when you add that to the equation, then all of a sudden there'll be new innovations, and that's where some of the innovations are coming from.
One last question to ask. So if I own an electric vehicle, I use my batteries to charge, discharge this vehicle, and my battery is dying sooner.
Yes.
So is that ever entering into this thing?
Absolutely. Yeah. So
shifting that burden to the car owners though, right?
So this is a very good question, very interesting question. So what happens is that the battery is actually warranted. The battery manufacturer, when they sell the battery to the car maker, they warrant for a certain number of cycles. The car maker takes the cycles and makes a certain assumption about you driving. So technically, when you buy a car, you're not supposed to be discharging into the grid. So if you do that, and they're able to detect it, which they are, because, you know, they can go in and see how many cycles of the wheel turned and how many cycles of the battery, and so they can figure that out. And so that would void your warranty, absolutely. And that's because the car maker is buying a certain number of cycles but selling you in miles, and they're taking that the hit. That means that somebody needs to take that hit for the cycles. And so, yeah, people have done research on the business case for, reducing the life of the battery by virtue of sending power to the grid. And, you know, there's a lot of different numbers out there. But based on my understanding that if the utilities get into the fray and they offer right levels of incentives to the EV owner, and, you know, for example, what is the value of one discharge to the utility? So that's one thing. The other thing is shallow discharge really does not take away. And remember, I talked of aggregation, and I didn't want to get into the details there. But one of the things I think is the aggregators can do is, let's say if there's 1,000 EVs, and if you knock off 5%. Of the energy from each EV, you're not doing much to the battery life. So there can be some interesting, and so I think some of that will depend upon the market and the regulators, what they offer through pricing, And then an aggregator can start a business in the future with using technology like what I'm trying to develop. And then hopefully, you know, but that there's a business case there, really. That's what it boils down to.
Okay, I think you'll stop at this stage.
Thank you.